This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Southern literature loves troubled families with dark pasts. In Philip Lewis's debut novel, a young man tries to escape the ties of his disturbed and distant father in the bleak, sorrowful mountain town he hates. In The Barrow Fields, Henry Astor manages to leave his past behind. He abandons his mother and sister that he vowed to protect, but soon enough, the inescapable ties of home and family pull him back. Author Philip Lewis has his own family demons, and in writing the novel, he drew from his youth in Western North Carolina. Philip Lewis joins me now to talk about his debut novel. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, let's talk about the fictional town first that you created, Old Buckram, North Carolina. Well, Old Buckram, anyway, in North Carolina.
Well, that's right. Old Buckram is a small town that I created, and it is set somewhere in the mountains of North Carolina. And what I say is it's somewhere near the place where the states of North Carolina and Virginia and Tennessee come together, and it's a small town. It's a bleak town, and what I wanted to do when I created Old Buckram was to create a place that when you read about it, you would understand some of the sensations and emotions that I experienced as a young man growing up in a small town in the mountains of North Carolina.
Which is why you decided, I think, perhaps to write a novel instead of a memoir.
Well, that's right. I've never thought that that you know the details of people's individual lives are necessarily very interesting, and I think that in order to really make experiences, emotional experiences, more broad enough so that people can understand and appreciate them, it's better to do it in a fictional context than to write about one's own personal experience.
And some of the streams and the currents that run through the novel have to do with the impact of literature and music, all of which have a profound effect on our emotions.
Well, that's right. One critic referred to the book as a love letter to literature. And books have always been so important to me and my family. Books have just been the defining aspect of our lives. And that is so much of what I wanted to communicate with this book.
A clue might be in the name of the town, Old Buckram. Tell us what Buckram is.
Well, Buckram is a type of linen or cotton that you stiffen it with glue and you use it to make book covers out of. And so, you know, one thing I tried to do here was to return to a more traditional style of storytelling, a storytelling that you find very often in the mountains. And so, I wanted to set part of this story in Old Buckram, which is to say within the covers of an old book.
Maybe you could read for us and give us a sample, would you?
Sure, I'd be happy to. What I'm going to read is just a couple of paragraphs from the beginning of the book, and it's going to tell you a little bit about the town of Old Buckram and where part of this story is set. My father was one of only two children born in Old Buckram's Cinderblock Hospital in the cold and bitter autumn of 1939. The other child, a young boy who didn't live long enough to get a name or a soul to be saved, was buried by his mother on a hillside near town when the ground warmed enough to dig him a proper grave. There was no service, and no one sang any hymns. The boy's headstone, if you could call it that, was a large, smooth rock from the creek. He was laid to rest with only his mother's voiceless prayer to an absent God. She asked that he be forgiven the original sin and kindly allowed into heaven to await the others when, in the Lord's wisdom, their day should come. Old Buckram, where this story begins, is an achromatic town high in the belly of the Appalachian Mountains. It's situated uneasily about as far north and west as you can go and still be inside the surveyed boundaries of North Carolina. In 1799, the population there was 125, and by 1939, this number had swelled to 400. It's a town where the streets and sidewalks are lonely and seldom traveled, where the few paltry shops, an aging hardware store, a feed store, a cobbler, a discount clothier, a cafe, and a headstone maker, scarcely see enough business for a living and close early in the dark days of winter before the snow falls. It's an old railroad town, but the train hasn't gone there in years. It's a town with one-room, red-brick churches on the hillsides and in the hollows, a town that believes in a God living but remote, and a town with one funeral home that buries almost all the dead. It's a town of ghosts and superstitions. It has the Devil's Stairs and Serpent's Tongue Rock and Abaddon Creek, which carried an entire family into oblivion in the flood of 1916. Up behind the creek at the edge of town lay the Barrow Fields, where by some mystery nothing of natural origin will grow except a creeping gray moss which climbs over mounds of rock and petrified stumps that the more credulous locals believe are grave markers from an age before time. Others say a great wind blow came up over the mountains 1,000 years ago and ripped out the trees and carried away all the goodness in the soil so that nothing could ever grow there again. Nearly everyone thinks it's haunted ground. There's never been a picnic on the Barrow Fields. Of that you can be sure.
Philip Lewis reading from his novel, The Barrow Fields. And so it is a town, clearly, that our protagonist, Henry Astor, can be forgiven if he'd like to leave and never come back to.
Well, I think that's right. But, it seems to be true of so many places, I think, where we grow up. We so desperately want to leave sometimes, perhaps because of a heritage that we're not proud of, or something similar. But I think in the South, where you grow up is so important a part of what your life is.
And it's more than the town. Henry's relationship with his father as well is another driving influence in this.
That's right. In fact, it's probably the fundamental driving influence.
Tell us more about that, about the two of these. Maybe we can set up their character a little bit and tell us more about their relationship.
Sure. Henry's father, Henry, of course, is the narrator for the story. And Henry's father is a very literary guy. He grows up in a small town, of course, Old Buckram, where there's not a single book in his family home except for the Holy Bible. And despite this, he grows up with this abiding love of literature that turns into an obsession. And he finally moves away. He can't wait to get out of Old Buckram. He escapes its gravity, and he moves away and becomes a writer of some acclaim. But his mother becomes sick, and he has to return to Old Buckram to care for her and look out for her. And the narrator, Henry, grows up in the shadow of his father's writing desk. And you can imagine what this is like. Every word that comes out of his father's mouth has some literary reference, some literary value. He's quoting T.S. Eliot or Thomas Wolfe. So this young man who grows up there in a house in Old Buckram filled with 10,000 books, he begins to see everything sort of through the lens of literature. And
he ends up leaving for college. So tell us more about that, this moment when he's got this aspiration. He's clearly absorbing some of this aspiration from his father and is both attracted and repelled by it in his formative years.
Well, that's right. There was a time in Henry's life when he viewed his father with great admiration. And as he grows older, some of that innocence is lost. And he comes to realize that perhaps his father's aspiration to be a great American writer may not come to fruition, and there may not have been as much reason to believe in his father as perhaps as a child he once had hoped.
There's a poignant scene later on in the book that I'd ask you to read for us. Maybe you can set it up for us.
Sure. This is a scene where Henry and his father go outside in the mountains. They're at their house, and they go outside to talk. And it's a bleak October day. The rain is moving in, and a tragedy has struck the family, and they're all trying to come to terms with it and trying to decide what their lives are going to look like moving forward. And so they sit down and have a conversation. Do you have any idea what you want to be when you grow up? I think it's a good time for us to talk about that. He forced himself awkwardly into the role of a parent and wavered there uncomfortably. I sensed this and adopted the corresponding persona of a dutiful son contemplating his future. I'm trying to decide, I said, but in fact I hadn't considered it for a single moment. Life seemed hardly to have begun for me. My days could still be agonizingly slow, and it was hard to see past the next summer. There was a time when all I really wanted to do was to be like him. I wanted to be a writer, maybe a lawyer too. I wanted to play sweetly sorrowful music by candlelight after everyone else had gone to bed. I wanted to be the solitary man reading at the edge of the barrow fields. I wanted to be all that he was before the sadness came, but those days had passed, and passed irretrievably. Thinking of all that had gone wrong, feeling a hateful bitterness inside me from his absence in my life, from my inability to understand him and his indifference to my inability to understand him, I bit my tongue almost through and said with perfect sarcasm, "Sometimes I think I'd like to be a writer." It was hard for me not to be angry, to be antagonistic toward him, and I meant this sentiment with a lifetime's burden of sardonic irony. "Like me," he said grimly. "Like you," I said, "just like you." "That's how I used to think of myself," he said. A black cat, not ours, walked along the top of the fence and disappeared into the howling woods. Father stood abruptly, shook out the rest of what was in his flask, and started back to the house. I called after him, "Where are you going?" He came reluctantly back and stood over me, the toes of our feet touching. "Why would you say that to me?" "Why would I say what to you?" "That you want to be a writer." "I don't know why I said it. Maybe I meant it." He studied my face, trying to divine the intent behind my words. He leaned over me in a great long arc, his immense black coat buoyed by the wind and spread out behind him like the wings of a bird. "I've never told you this before, but I raised you to be a writer," he said. "I thought maybe one day you would be. All those books I read to you, all those stories. You don't even remember, do you? But I see now in light of me, that's not going to happen." "You didn't mean it," he said acerbically. "I know you didn't mean it." "I'm sorry." I realized I'd hurt him more than I had intended. He just kept shaking his head. His disappointment wouldn't leave him. "You," he started. "I thought..." More head shaking. "You thought what?" "I thought maybe you, of all people, would understand." He turned and walked away from me, and in a great rushing of wind, the crows rove into the air above our heads and followed him across the field.
Philip Lewis reading from his debut novel, The Barrow Fields, and we're talking about it today on The State of Things. It's a powerful passage, and I wonder how you came to write it, because the narrator, Henry, reports that there was a great deal of he spoke it with as much irony and as sardonic a mood as he could muster. But there's some truth in it. He does come back, and there is some attraction to this place that his father made and his father's business. And I wonder how you as a writer come to a scene like that, whether you feel the inherent truth in Henry's desire to be somewhat like his father or connect with his father, and then the irony in saying, you know, you're a failure, and I guess you're pushing me in the same direction, right?
So many of these scenes are amalgamations, I would say, of experiences that I've had. My father, at one time, wanted to be a writer, and not a writer like Henry's father in the story, but a writer nonetheless. And I think that there were times in my life when I would look at him and imagine him as something that perhaps that he was not. And later on, he became afflicted with depression and alcoholism. He's a depressive alcoholic, and he struggled with that his entire life. And it's all, frankly, he's lucky to be alive at this very moment, and he's probably just barely alive. And so some of those expressions of feeling and grief and angst between the son and the father, even though the context is different in my life than what's set forth in the book, they come from a very honest place.
Well, that's it. I think that shows you the power of literature and those feelings, the feelings on the one hand, the anxieties and the desires on the one hand, and then the power of literature and words to both conceal and reveal our precise feelings, a kind of expose done in a sardonic tone that really tells you what I feel.
Well, that's exactly right. And there's much more of that in the book. Mm. Is the they both try to come to come to terms with how they view each other.
Music as well plays an important part in this book.
Music does. Music has always played a very important part in my life. And I play the guitar and I like to try to play the piano, although I don't do it particularly well. And there's so many wonderful pieces of classical music that I wrote into the book. But there's also, there's music from the mountains, Doc Watson, for example, which you know, sort of brings what happens in the Astor families into sharp relief, where there's Chopin and Liszt and Schubert and late period Beethoven all the time in their house on the hill. But I can't imagine what life would be like without Chopin, for example. And so being familiar with these particular pieces and knowing the emotional content that they would have, I would find scenes that I would really write around these pieces of music. And what I would do is I would try to establish, for example, the emotional quality of a particular nocturne. And so I would write it into the story, but I would put it on and I would listen to it while I was writing. And so not only is it in the story, but, you know, there it is. It's helping me craft the scene that's being written.
The scenes are written in the novel The Barrow Fields, the debut novel of my guest Philip Lewis, who will be reading from his novel this Thursday, 3 o'clock at Hickman's Crossroads Library in Calabash, North Carolina, and then on Friday at 6:30 South Main Book Company in Salisbury. Philip, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely happy to be here. Thank you so much.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.